Blog Talk Radio.
There is the right show.
Blog Talk Radio.
The car became a problem later.
You have tuned in to the Brain Injury Radio Network, with shows 7 nights a week. You can find the network at braininjuryradio.com or look up Brain Injury Radio Network on Facebook. Another Fork in the Road with your host, Donna O'Donnell-Figurski.
Hi, and welcome to the Brain Injury Radio Network on blogtalkradio.com. My name is Donna O'Donnell-Figurski, and I am the host on my show, Another Fork in the Road. And I'm just going to say something right here. I just came out of a picture book conference with Lynn Marie, and she has a book called, I don't remember the entire title, but I think it's Forketo. So I told her today I'm going to honorary name the show in honor of her book, and we're going to call it Another Forketo in the Road today. And it's okay because it's going to be a little different show than normal anyhow. So that works for me. But my show airs on the first and the third Sunday of every month at 5:30 p.m. Pacific time. And Another Forketo in the Road is for anyone with a brain injury, anyone who is caring for a brain-injured person, or anyone with any interest in learning more about brain injury. Brain injury is not discriminating. It can happen to anyone, anytime, and anywhere. And frankly, the Brain Trauma Foundation states that there are more than 5 million people in the United States, just in the United States. We broadcast all over the world here, but I'm just talking United States, more than 5 million people with some form of brain injury. Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot. And most folks don't even know about brain injury. Even with that high astronomical number, folks really don't get it. And I think they're starting to get it a little bit now, but it hasn't been very, prominent in the news at all. And I didn't even know about it came to land on my doorstep. And in 2005, that happened to me. But on Another Fork in the Road, I try to raise awareness of brain injury and to help folks understand what survivors and caregivers experience, because it's not a solitary disease. Yes, the survivor does have the disease, does have the complications and the disabilities with it, but it does get shared by their caregivers, their loved ones that are helping them through on this journey. So on the third Sunday of every month, I interview brain injury survivors and caregivers to see how they traverse their world of brain injury. I also hold therapists, medical professionals, and authors to gain insight into what they offer survivors and caregivers. And on each Sunday, the first Sunday of the month, that would be today, I host a discussion panel to examine pertinent topics related to brain injury, such as depression or neural fatigue, anger, many different symptoms of brain injury. And so just to tell you a little wee bit about me, for those of who are new to the show, and I hope there are lots, here's a snippet about me. I came on the brain injury scene in 2005. It wasn't a choice. But when my husband David had a brain injury, I was plummeted into this life with him. You can learn more about that on my blog. Now, this is where I always remember to say, make sure you have a pen and paper nearby, because I will be throwing out URLs that you might want to check later on after the show has ended. So survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com is my blog. And you will find so much information on there, including interviews from caregivers and survivors, a lot of brain injury networking, meaning resources. The new news is up. just tons of stuff. So I'm not going to go through it all. Just go take a peek and meander through and see if there's anything there for you. I shared my story, and David's actually story and my story, in four episodes on this show starting in August of 2014 when I first became a host on the Brain Injury Radio Network. And my the last show was also in November of 2014, featured David. The last show in that episode featured David himself. And I also interviewed David on my April 19, 2020 show for his perspective on his brain injury after 15 years of living this this life. And because David is a retired professor of microbiology, he from Columbia University, I wanted his understanding of the COVID-19 pandemic. And remember I said that was in April. So we were just getting started on this pandemic in the beginning of, well, March was our first time when we went into isolation, but it had been happening in the country for quite a while since then, and around the world even much longer. So, so Dave, you can find that information on my blog, too, if you want to know more about the COVID-19 through a scientist's view. David, what David does is he reads the scientific articles. He knows a lot of the professors still at Columbia that are doing this actual research and work on it. And then he puts it into layman's terms. I mean, laywoman's terms, lay people's terms. He puts it into terms that I can understand. If I can understand what he's saying, then you can too, okay? Because it's really, I mean, when scientists put this stuff out, it's very convoluted. So anyway, you can find my archived shows, all of my shows, and I've been on the Brain Injury Radio now for 6 years, I guess. Wow, that's a long time, 6 years. And I've got about 100, I don't know, I get this wrong every time, I think 129. Every time after the show, I ask David, and I say, okay, I'll remember next time. And I never do. But I think it's 129. And if I'm wrong, he'll tell me. But you can find all those shows, all the archived shows, on my blog at survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Just click the On the Air show menu. It's a tab under the category section to the right side on the right sidebar. And that's really, really easy to get all the shows. You can also find them on demand at Blog Talk Radio. But it's a little bit harder, like a whole lot harder, to find them there. But so I always put them on my blog so it's easy. And then you can just scroll through, check out the topics you want to listen to, and click away. So if you want to know more about David, just put in David Figurski, F-I-G-U-R-S-K-I, in the search bar on the right sidebar to learn more. And the search bar is your friend. Put anything up there that you want to know. You can also read our complete story. Yeah, I wrote a book called Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, and which was published by Right Life Publishing and released in November of 2018. And you can find Prisoners, as I so fondly call it, as an e-book and as a print book at all your local book haunts. I hope to have the audio version completed shortly. I used to say I hope to have it completed by summer, but since we passed by the summer end of summer date, I'm hoping to have the audiobook completed by early fall. It's in with the publishing company now. It's just waiting to get shuffled through all the different audiobooks that are getting published. So hopefully that'll be soon. So go to my website, DonnaFigurski.com, to learn more about me. And if you go there, I promise you will learn more than you ever wanted to know. And I hope that you're going to find my show tonight fun and informative. And I hope that you'll visit the shows of the other hosts on Brain Injury Radio. There are shows every night between 5 p.m. and 10 p.m. Pacific. Mind you, Pacific time. Okay, and so just make your conversion, time conversions there. From 5 to 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. Pacific on the weekend. Nope, let me go back again. 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific time on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. On the weekend, we start at 5:30. That would be Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Okay, so you can also listen to the Brain Injury Radio Network airs across the United States in all 50 states and in 36 countries. So now sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. And before we even begin, well, sort of, actually we are beginning, I guess. Tonight's show is called a Mishmash Show. It still has the panelists on, but it's going to be a little bit different from my regular panelist shows. And there's our tribute to Pittsburgh as the train goes by out of Deb Brandon's window. I always love that train. It comes on every time. I, as a college student, folks, I rode that train into Pittsburgh every day for school from McKeesport, PA. So I have a love affair with that train. So tonight's show is going to be different, as I said, from my regular show. But just like brain injury has turned the lives of survivors and their caregivers, their family, and their friends' lives upside down, I'm actually going to turn this panel upside down today. And instead of me being the host, I am turning it over to two of my regular panelists, and they get to ask me questions. They get to choose the topic, and I have no idea what they're going to ask me. So it's going to be kind of interesting. It's kind of like how I put my guests on the hot seat. They never know. They know the topic we're talking about, but they never know my questions. So I'm going to get a taste of that tonight, and I'm really looking forward to it. So let me welcome my panelists to you now. First, Fruit Grace Mosey is a teen and parent counselor and a wellness consultant. She is also the mother of Jamie Crane Mosey, a professional skier who had a brain injury while competing at the World Tour Finals in Whistler, Canada in 2015. Fruit's life reverted from a parent of a very competent and independent young adult to a role she thought she had fulfilled years ago as Jamie was growing up. But when Jamie's injury reduced her to an infantile state, unable to do anything for herself, Fruit again became her caregiver. So you can find out a lot more about Fruit on my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. Okay, Fruit has been a friend and a regular panelist on my panel for many years, and she's very willing to share her insightful knowledge as a caregiver. Fruit has also just gone back to school to get her PhD, and that is pretty remarkable because she's already got her plate pretty full, but she's put another thing on there, and I'm sure she's going to just do it very, very well. Deb Brandon, let me introduce Deb Brandon to you. Deb is a regular and panelist on my show, and she's also been a friend for a while. Deb is a brain injury survivor who learned of her brain injury when physicians discovered a cavernous angioma in her brain. A cavernous angioma is a malformation of blood vessels that usually results in slow blood flow, which may cause a myriad of symptoms, including headaches, seizures, and even paralysis. Usually cavernous angiomas are congenital. That means that persons are born with them. And very often you might live your entire life without even knowing you had one up there, and that would be very fortunate. Deb is the author of her book, But My Brain Had Other Ideas, a memoir of recovery from brain injury. Deb is now a retired professor of mathematics from Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, where that old train was going by, and as I said earlier, my old stomping grounds. I was born outside of Pittsburgh and went to college there. So, yeah, I have a great, big, huge feel for Pittsburgh. You can read about Deb on my blog. Everybody say it all at once, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. In the search box, type her name, Deb Brandon, B-R-A-N-D-O-N. A Survivor Speak Out interview will pop up, and so will many shows of another fork in the road on which Deb has appeared. So, and you can also learn more about Deb at her own website, debbrandon.com/. So it's debbrandon.com. So check them out. But wait, don't open some mics here. Ladies, how are you today? And welcome to the show. And what's in store for me?
Hello, this is Deb. What we're going to talk about today is how one's relationship with oneself changes through brain injury. And we're not just talking about survivors, but also caregivers. It's, these sort of things are referred to as life-changing experiences, and and you only really think about the person with a brain injury who's undergone a life-changing experience, but that's also true of a caregiver. And therefore, we want to talk about how things change for you, how you've changed, that kind of thing.
Sounds perfect
Fruit?
To me.
Fruit, you want to take it?
Yeah, hi, this is Fruit, and as always, it's so great to be with both of you for these panel shows. What would you say, Donna, the first kind of, like, the first reactions that you had? Like, the very first reactions that were happening. Can you remember?
Do I remember? It's a movie in my head. Yes, I remember.
Yeah.
I don't know where you want me to start the reel, though. The very first thing... Okay, the very first thing would have been when David came into our bedroom with his hand covering his eye, his right eye, and I knew something was drastically wrong. I knew something was very, very wrong. I didn't want it to be wrong. I would like to have said, go away, you know, but I knew something was wrong because he doesn't succumb easily to any pain. And when he came in and just kind of like fell upon the bed, and the pain was so obvious, I was scared. I was scared because he was covering his eye. I knew his eye. I knew it had to be in something in his head. And I knew that I had to take over right then. And that was scary because usually David would be the takeover person. Not that I wasn't ever. I mean, I had the children, and of course I had to react all the time with the children's things that were going on and you know, accidents. And I'm pretty level-headed that way. But I just knew something was really wrong and things were going to change at that point.
So basically, it's really important to know that as the caregiver, one of the first things that can happen, it's not necessarily just the fear of the brain injury. It's just the fear of this. And as you say, Donna, you were not somebody who didn't do things. You weren't just a sit back and let it take care of everything. You were a very competent, level-headed, you said also. And then all of a sudden there's this fear of something so unknown, right?
Exactly. Like, yes, exactly.
You know, and it wasn't, maybe it wasn't, I don't know, but you think, like, so tell me a little, tell us a little more about what that fear is. Like what, like the unknown, how was it different? Like if he'd come in and his arm was broken, would you have had the same fear?
No, not at all. Not at all. Because it was doing with his brain, with his head. And I knew something was wrong in his brain. So, yeah, an arm, if he had his arm broken, I would have been upset. I would have been, you know, sympathetic for him and everything. And I wouldn't have liked it. I would have had to go on into some kind of motion there in getting him help. But it wouldn't have been dire. And when he came in here, and again, when this was all happening, I wasn't really thinking brain injury. I mean, I didn't think that at all, frankly, because... I didn't even, as I mentioned earlier, I didn't know anything about brain injury. I, you know, if you had said cancer or Alzheimer's or if you had said Parkinson's or MS or any number of things, I would be able to say, yeah, I've heard of that. I know what you're talking about. But I didn't even put a name to it at that point, other than the fact that he had a very severe ache in his head, and it wasn't a headache. So it was like scary beyond belief. When you have to call an ambulance, because that's not something we do lightly. And I, at that point, I had never done it. So I was scared. And so I called the ambulance, and I called them several times to get them faster. And, of course, they didn't get there any faster just because I called. But that's how panicky I was becoming. It wasn't until I had met his neurosurgeon. And he said to me that, excuse me, that your husband is in very good health. He had seen his brain on the computer at home, that your husband's in really good health. So he'll make a very good organ donor. I think that was my clue that something was drastically wrong. And I really went into a panic at that part, because now I'm starting to think about organ donor. No. He's not going to be an organ donor because I'm not going to let him stay here to be an organ donor. No, I left his wallet at home, so you don't even know he's an organ donor, which he was. Of course, now when I think about it, these are all thoughts going through my head at that time. You asked me if I remember. Right. Oh, yeah, I do remember. But afterwards, if you think about it, they would have been able to easily look up his records and find out he was an organ donor. And I'm not sure I could have overridden that, you know. So, people, beware. I know it's an honorable thing, but I'm not going to be an organ donor because I would prefer to live and try to get through, because I'm not sure David would have made it through if he were. If they had, you know, if I said, yeah, he's an organ donor, go for it. So, yeah, that's when I realized that we were in a really serious situation.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so one starts out with the whole trauma, with the shock and everything, mm-hmm. and both caregivers and brain injury survivors. For caregivers, it's I know the brain injury survivor side, that you're not exactly in a good frame of mind to go through normal, quote-unquote, normal reactions like shock or whatnot. Mm-hmm. And you're really not with it. What happens, I mean, as a brain injury survivor, I know that at first in my case, I had these brain bleeds, and then I ended up with having brain surgeries to prevent future bleeds. And at first, after the brain bleeds, when things were going very, very wrong, my entire world was tiny. It was all about me and my mm-hmm. difficulties and nothing else. And I had no room in my tiny little world for anyone else. Everything else was in the periphery. I just didn't see it. Now, with a caregiver, yeah. that would be different. I mean, yes, your world would be small, but it wouldn't be centered on you so much. So what can you say to that?
Oh, my world wasn't centered on me at all. My world
right.
was completely focused on David. I mean, just put yeah. blinders on me, put a funnel on me, and that was mm-hmm. what you would notice. It would be just David. I wasn't thinking of me. And fortunately, at that time, my children were grown. So mm-hmm. you can't say this for all caregivers, because a lot of caregivers go into this and still have the responsibility of caring for their young ones, their little children,
yeah.
or their teens. And so I didn't have that, which was fortunate, actually, for me, because mm-hmm. I was able to give my every bit of attention to David. And, I took the back seat on everything. But it wasn't a conscious taking a back seat. It was the only thing I could do. I mean, mm-hmm. I was looking mm-hmm. at him and saying, this is where every bit of my energy had to go to get him well again. And it wasn't sure that he was going to get well. He had 3 brain surgeries in less than 2 weeks, and he wasn't given a very good chance of living through any of them. So mm-hmm. it was touch and go constantly. And I never wrapped my head around the fact that he wasn't going to live. Of course, it was there niggling at me, but I couldn't go to that point at this point, and I couldn't go there unless it happened, you know, because mm-hmm. otherwise mm-hmm. I couldn't have functioned, period, if I mm-hmm. thought that way. So I just took every single minute of my days, one second at a time, and just being in that moment and not thinking beyond it. So, how I handled it.
So basically, okay, that's an interesting way of putting it, because you're saying you're living in the moment, you're focusing on the moment. Now, from a brain injury survivor point of view, the focusing in the moment is, again, it's a focus on themselves, whereas your
mm-hmm.
focusing in the moment is about focusing on the brain injury survivor. So it's a great
True.
Way of putting it, because, yes, it's the same, it comes from the same source, you're focusing on the moment, but then the focus is on, for
mm-hmm.
brain injury, it's on themselves. For the caregiver, it's on the brain injury survivor. But whatever is going on, you're talking about, your world is tiny. There's nothing
yes.
else going on.
Yes.
So,
it became a hospital room.
Yeah.
And I'm going to add a little bit, because I did have a couple of teenagers when this was going on, and one of them was an older teenager, but the other one was like right in the middle. And so as much as every part of me was, when Jamie was in the hospital and in the hospital recovery, every part of me wanted to 100% only pay attention to the needs
mm-hmm.
of Jamie. And I had to make sure that this other child of mine, who luckily, you know, I mean, it would have been much harder if she'd been three, or, you know, if my other children
yeah.
had been three and eight or three and seven or something. But she was a teenager, and teenagers are, as we all know, very needy people.
Yes.
And she managed to like, pull myself out of the Jamie only. It's very, like you were saying, Donna, it's excruciating. It's like painful to try
mm-hmm.
to do that. And for her to be seeing her sister in that condition, you know, it's really hard. I don't know. I think a three-year-old takes a lot more time, a lot more effort in a lot of ways, but they wouldn't have the same cognitive understanding of what's happening to their siblings or their parent that a 14-year-old has. So,
well, exactly.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
again, looking at that same issue from the point of view of the brain injury survivor, I had two teenagers
oh,
at the time.
Yes.
My daughter was starting a new school, middle school. My son, I think he was his last year in middle school, or I forget when he... He was either in his, yeah, he was in his last year in middle school. But I couldn't cope as a mother. I just couldn't cope. And at first, they really weren't in that tiny sphere that was all I could cope with. So
mm-hmm.
slowly, your world opens up a bit. I mean, in your case, Fruit, it opened up to encompass your other kid. In my case, mm-hmm. it had to open up in that direction. So again, I assume if they're not kids around you, slowly your world starts to open up and you start. Well, for instance, so with Donna, with you, you moved David to another hospital. Just the mere fact that you could think of it in terms of doing that, that shows me that your world had opened up to some extent. So I think what
happened is,
go ahead.
I was just going to say, I knew that he needed to have his extreme care, and I
yeah.
didn't feel that this hospital was going to give it to him, so I had to do that. But
right.
in doing so, I also, just to credit the people that helped me, there were a lot of people that were able to make those wheels move for me while I still focused on my tiny little world. So I was
mm-hmm.
fortunate that David's department chairman and his and some of his former students who were medical doctors over at Columbia had the wherewithal to put into motion his transfer. I didn't do anything
mm-hmm.
other than make a phone call and say, help, you know, and they took over. So I was very fortunate there because I don't think I could have done that, you know. I mean, I don't know what I would have done, how to do it, you know. So I have to give the credit where it is due because that isn't something that most people can just do easily.
Yeah, so I think
that's such an important part because we're talking about, you know, changes in the relationship of the caregiver and changes of relationship for the person who's had the traumatic brain injury also, or the brain injury. Either way, this change for Donna, I bet, Donna, you weren't a, let me call and say help. I bet
no.
you were a,
no.
you were a, oh, there's a problem. Oh, I can solve it. Oh, you have a problem? Give it to me. I'm capable. And so this change, I mean, it's so pervasive that when it happens, when the change happens, it's kind of the ask for help is also like it's a combination of control and help, like, which in normal circumstances, if you're asking for help, it's not usually in the same context of control.
Right.
And I think that's something. Go ahead.
I just think you're very right. I wasn't a person that ever asked for help. I never did. I always took care of things. When David and I got married, when I went away to college, I never returned home to live. Went home for visits and things, but never returned home. So at the young age of 17, I was out of the house. I was in control of my life at that point. When David and I got married, we never, ever lived in the same town as family. So we were always together on our own. If I needed help, I went to David. If he needed help, he came to me. Or we solved anything together. And so it was never a matter of going saying, Mom, can you do this? Or Dad, can you do this? Or friend down the street. Mm-mm, it wasn't. So I was completely alone in that respect. And in fact, I don't think I even so much asked for help is when I called his department chairman to tell him that David was, in the hospital and in surgery. He said, we're going to get him over here. I mean, he basically made that decision. And I said, okay, go with it. You know, so I basically gave it to him. But otherwise, no, I would never have gone to ask for help. I would have tried to figure that out myself, which would have been hard.
Okay. But we're back to that same idea that you're in a situation, it's a completely new situation. The only thing you can do is focus on this one thing, in your case, David, and if you see very little outside that sphere, we can't cope out beyond that sphere. We can't cope beyond that moment.
Mm-hmm.
But then, as I said, slowly your world opens up a bit. In my case, I became more aware of the kids and tried to do, this is after the surgeries, and tried to do more with them, which wasn't much because at the time I couldn't drive and I was too tired to do a lot of things. But still, when you're going through, even in the early days, I would, you know, for brain injury survivors and for caregivers, there's still a lot of focus. Most of the focus is on that little sphere. It's grown a bit, but you're still focused on it. So, And how did that? Go ahead.
I was just going to take it over to David's, what was happening with David at that time when you're saying about everything's focused on the small world of him. And for David, as the survivor, his world became the me world. You know, everything revolved around him. He couldn't see beyond that. And the reason I know that is because I got tired of my name. It was constantly, Donna, can you get me this? Donna, where's this? Donna, I need this. Mm-hmm. Donna. And I was like, oh, my God, please change my name. But, but the point is, he became almost like a two-year-old. And I watched David from his very beginning when this happened, when the injury first happened, to now, okay? It took him years to go through that stage that infants go through really pretty, you know, and children go through. It takes them years, but it didn't take David that long. But, I mean, I watched him go through each one of those stages, being the infant mm-hmm. who was totally helpless and couldn't do anything, going to the terrible twos. Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw terrible twos in a 50-year-old, 50-something-year-old man, you know? But it was mostly the me thing. It was mostly that.
Yeah.
It wasn't
yeah.
anything really nasty stuff. No, actually, he did get pretty yucky for a while there. It was uncontrolled. He was not able to control himself,
right.
And I was scared of him for a little bit. Uh-huh. This was when he was first brought home from the hospital. I was scared uh-huh. of him. In fact, I even called my son in California and said, you have to hear what's going on in this house. You know, and David is a mm-hmm. gentle guy, and we don't have these kinds of things that I would ever be scared of him, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, oh, my gosh. Fortunately, he wasn't able to move, so I knew that if he was on the couch and I was in the other room, he wasn't going to get to me. But, you know, it was just awful. It was just awful. And then he proceeded on to that me stage, and then he went into that real sweet stage, you know, when they turn like about 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and they're really nice and sweet. And then he went into the teen years.
Oh.
I'm not kidding you. I mean, it sounds funny, but
it's true.
I know it's a normal progression. And he went into the teen years and he got very obstreperous. And complaining and just obnoxious with me, you know. And it was a short-lived thing. It didn't last a whole long. I'm not sure I would have said it was short-lived when I was going through it. But but now you can look back on it and say, okay. And then he got out of the teens and he got into his young adult and his adulthood. And now he's normal. He's normal again. He's normal.
That's
a brain injury can allow you to be.
Yeah, now that's interesting hearing about it from your point of view, because from my point of view, I was very resentful towards my then husband. I was a lot of resentment.
Uh-huh.
And for various reasons. And we ended up getting divorced, so part of it was to do with our relationship anyway. But, and there was anger in me. I mean, compared to some brain injury survivors, I was very lucky that it wasn't horrific or anything. And the worst I did was threw the phone on the bed. But I was very angry at one point. So I can only imagine what it's like from the other side. This is actually helping me figure out what happened between my ex-husband and I. So, yeah, there's that side of it. And, again, we're back to the brain injury survivor is me. And you're going,
mm-hmm.
I'm fed up with you.
But I never let him know that. Hold it. Deb, I want to qualify that. He never knew I was feeling that way.
Of course
he never
not.
Knew. I never, I would never let him know that. I would just bang my head against the wall in the other room. But then I'd come in with a smile and say, sure, what do you need? Because I just felt like he needed as much as I could give to him.
Right.
And I was fine, so I had to be able to be the one to do that. Because he couldn't, and it wasn't his fault that he couldn't do it. And it's not even his fault that he was me-ing either, you know, and I knew that. But I also I knew it cognitively and emotionally, but I also went like, oh, you know.
Yeah,
but it's, you know, and I think it's a natural feeling for people, for caregivers. And I think you have to understand, don't beat yourself up over it. Because you've got to deal with it.
I think the progression that you mentioned, Donna, and maybe, you know, you're kind of looking back at it. Also, is that progression, you know, the more caregivers that I talk to about the progression of recovery, there's so many that talk about, you know, from the infancy to the 2-year-old to that 3 to 8-year-old, 10-year-old, then they go into those teen years again, and then they go into the young adult. And with all of that, you as the caregiver have to, and it's less predictable than the unpredictability of a child growing up.
Mm-hmm.
Because
yeah.
One thing is, I had no idea that Jamie would be going through all the stages again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, after a while, I'm like, oh, she's a teenager. Yeah, okay, well, that makes sense. You know, it took me from the infancy till her, you know, her rebellious teenager years to or recovery time to realize, oh, we've gone through this whole stage. One of the things
yeah.
we noticed was that physically her facial features as she matured did change to match
uh-huh.
the maturity level that she was in. We did notice that, but we didn't put two and two because we were, as you were saying, we were so involved in that process of Jamie, that we did not like, oh, now she's like a 2-year-old. But we didn't say, oh, well, then therefore after two, she's going to be like that.
Right.
Three to 8 year old. We didn't say that. We just
right.
said, oh, now she's like, and then at the same time, there's a little other things that were kind of floating in there, like the repetitive thinking that she would have.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going through these stages that seem sort of natural one after the other from the infancy on. There's that going on. And then there's the whammo of the emotion from depression to elation, you
mm-hmm.
know, that they don't know how to control differently. And it's not the same as a 5-year-old having those kinds of emotions. They're you know, they're switched because of the brain injury.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it does kind of mess up smoothly going along chronological ages. They have these other things that get in. Or like David, when he was a teenager, and I believe, if I remember correctly, you were sweethearts from like a childhood practically, right?
Yeah, from 16.
Yeah.
Since we were teenagers.
Yeah, and he wasn't the way he was when he was his recovering teenager. The recovering teenager was very different than
yeah.
the actual teenager. And
yeah,
I don't think he was an
obnoxious teenager. I don't think. I don't think his parents would have ever said that he was. He was.
And
so yeah.
And he didn't even have the personality to be an obnoxious teenager. And Jamie was never an obnoxious teenager, but she was.
I was.
Was a,
well, how? Why am I surprised?
Yeah, I'm not surprised either. But my point is that the recovery stages aren't necessarily the same as the original stages. And so,
mm-hmm.
so to just say, oh well, she's a pretty cool teenager, so she'll be a pretty cool recovery teenager. It didn't happen in life.
Well, also there's the side
yeah.
of it, for instance, with teenagers, okay, when you add to that, for instance, with brain injury survivors who have that rage thing, I mean, we're talking
mm-hmm.
people who are able to cause major harm, whereas when
uh-huh.
your average teenager
yeah.
doesn't have that.
Right. Right,
but
exactly.
But the other thing is, okay, you're talking about it from the point of view, you two are caregivers and you acted as caregivers. I didn't have someone like that. My ex-husband, he resented having to do things for me, and he placed obstacles in my way. So I had a very different relationship with my caregivers were long distance. So I never really had someone, you know,
yeah.
to check me or to I
mm-hmm.
it was no,
and that's too
I
bad.
Didn't have
that
this
is
back
that's
and forth.
An awful yeah, that's an awful shame.
And there are a lot of brain injury survivors who don't have that.
And even if they...
A lot.
Jamie and David, we're kind of lucky to have had Donna and me because for some reason we were good at being caretakers of the recovery, of that recovery process. And there are people who want to be a good caretaker, but I had the freedom to do so. I did not have to go to a job that took my time and energy. But if you're somebody who, to be able to keep the insurance to cover the recovery, and you have to go to work, and Donna took time off from being a teacher. She didn't have to, and I had a career, but it wasn't a career that, it was a career that I could, I didn't do my career for, a year or so, and then because I could not do it. But when people don't have that privilege, no matter, even if they're, there were things going on with your husband that caused you to, through the brain injury, it exacerbated things enough that you did end up getting divorced. But there's a lot of people who the brain injury, so we're talking about changes that happen to you from like the relationship side, like to yourself. And so I'm wondering for you, was the divorce something a positive, a negative? I mean, I don't want to
positive.
Be really personal. I'm talking about your, so it was positive. So somehow from the brain injury, the divorce came, it was positive, and it, you had a new power in yourself.
Yes, yes.
And I think that's an important thing, is that you, people lose things, but they have the opportunity to gain.
I gained a lot. I gained a lot. I really did. I think if it weren't for the brain injury, I would have stayed in the relationship for much longer. It would have lasted longer, but it would have been a more agonizing death, put it that way. So that brings us back to this whole idea of whether you have this smaller world and then it starts opening up. Now, for a brain injury survivor, opening up means rediscovering the world in many ways. And you start becoming aware of the impact of, for instance, your behavior on the people around you. In my case, it was not a particularly good thing because we didn't get along. But I mean, in your case, I mean, the effect... probably, I would assume, on a situation where you have a good caregiver, it means that the brain injury survivor becomes more aware of, more appreciative of what you're doing, and in some sense probably helps it become easier to help them, in the sense of you feel it's more satisfying in a way. But on the other hand... Yeah, go ahead.
I'm going to have to interrupt.
Uh-huh.
And then you can do your other hand. So
when one hand at a time, folks.
Yep. When Jamie was through the 10-year-old, she was everything I suggested and I wanted her to do, and let's do this U.S. history so you can jar your brain back, let's do opening jars with your hand, the hand that was whatever. It's like she just did everything.
Mm-hmm.
And she thought it was fun and exciting. But when she went into those second set of teenage years, it was not fun. I did not feel appreciated. She wanted to do things and her sister, who is the next below her, who they were super tight, They really had a major separation, which had they been married, kind of not in a weird way. They would have been divorced. They would not have survived through the recovery as a couple. So even though, and that was the most caregiving of all of her sisters. So she has four sisters and me and her dad. Now her dad isn't a caregiver. So it's not a bad thing. It's just a fact. But of four sisters, that particular sister was above and beyond. If I was 100, she was 80.
Mm-hmm.
Not percent, just like mm-hmm.
yeah.
like if the highest that anybody could give for caregiving is 100, so I would be at 100, and she would have mm-hmm. been at 80, like not very far behind.
Okay.
And then the other three sisters, would have been. One was probably at 60 for a couple of months, but then she went down to 0 to 10 because she didn't
mm-hmm.
live with us anyway. The one who lived in mm-hmm. Connecticut, you know, wasn't a daily caregiver, and the teenager was off to boarding school in Massachusetts. So they all went to pretty much a 0 to 20, depending on if they were in town. Honestly, though, they would not have remained, but because Jamie couldn't live alone yet, and Jeannie lived in a house, they had to work through some things. And then when Jamie moved into her apartment, she was like, you know, like, I can do it all myself. I don't need any
mm-hmm.
help with anything.
Mm-hmm.
So she was not, and she now looks back on it and is like totally appreciative. But for about a 2-year period of time, she was vacillated between being completely needy and completely appreciative to I don't need any help, and not appreciating when the help did show up.
Yeah.
I didn't
have that caregiving, so
I can't even imagine how hard that could have been.
So that's really interesting that you start, again, we start with a small bubble, living in the moment, and then it starts growing, and then that's when the emotions start getting in, the interaction, the emotional interaction.
Yes.
Donna, you were saying that with...
Good? Go ahead.
That it was tough dealing with when David started getting out of the me phase, when he started,
mm-hmm.
how did things start changing for you?
Well, I don't think anything real. I mean, it probably was a little more relieving. But like I said, I would never have let him know. He knows now, of course.
Right.
I meant to put that in the book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, but I actually forgot. It was one of the parts I really wanted to put in the book because I thought that was really cool, but I think I didn't put that in there. But how it didn't really change that much, other than it was a little bit more relieving that he wasn't constantly demanding things, asking for things, not demanding, asking more. And he was
mm-hmm.
asking, and I understood because he was immobile. He couldn't get up
mm-hmm.
and get it, so it wasn't like he was just saying, you know, would you get this for me? I wasn't catering to him. He was unable, and so I had to do it. But, yeah, it was tiring. So when he got out of that and went into the sweetness, and now you have to understand, too, that I didn't label all of these things at the time. It didn't come to me till much, much later what had gone on. So I wasn't thinking of him being a terrible two when he was in the me stage or the sweet stage. it didn't happen until maybe 10, 15, oh, well, it's 15 years now. So it happened probably about 10 years after that, or maybe a little less, that I realized what had happened, that we had watched this. And it wasn't only the emotional and behavioral type things. It was also physical, because he was learning how to walk again too. So it was not even just isolated thing. He was really doing the whole thing. We had a baby born across the street, and we would watch her when her mom would take her out to play. And we'd watch her toddle down across the yard. And David says, "I think she's doing better than I am already." You know, that kind of thing. You know, and so we were both aware of that. And so that was like about 2 years in. And I think we were both very much aware of what was going on with him at that point. So, you know, I don't know if I answered your question, Deb, and I know you're trying to get this question out.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is this idea of, okay, we start out talking about our relationship with ourselves. I mean, only now I'm 13 years since the whole thing. Only now, through my writing, through talking on your show, am I beginning to understand just how awful I was. And I'm beginning to understand, well, okay, when I talk about my relationship with myself, partly because of the writing, I'm really thinking about it a lot. The way I perceive the world is totally different from the way I perceived it before the brain injury, the way I perceived it during the early days of the brain injury, and the way I do now. It's very, very different. Uh-huh. There's major changes. And I'm much more honest with myself than I was. I mean, I thought I was being honest with myself, but there's no comparison. Now I'm much more honest with myself. I'm much more aware of my weaknesses and much more aware of my strengths. Now, I would assume that as a caregiver, that would be the same thing. Again, through a different journey, but still the same thing. I mean, you go for a brain injury survivor, you start with being needy. Me, 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 me. And for a caregiver, you start out with you, 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 you. And then it starts getting harder to maintain that. And eventually, for instance, you realize that you have to take care of yourself. And that's when I think that's when something inside you is changing quite dramatically. So what can you say to that?
Well, I think that I get what you're saying there totally. In the beginning, like you said, it was all me focusing on David and everything, and that was okay. I didn't have any problem with that. That was my life. I mean, David's my husband. He's my best friend. I didn't think of myself as a caregiver. It took me until 2013 when I met an agent, and she said, you know, this book, my book, Prisoners Without Bars, was called Prisoner Without Bars. And she looked at me and said, no, this is Prisoners Without Bars. And I argued with her a little bit. But that's when I realized, now that, mind you, that was 8 years out, that I realized that, wait a minute, I'm a caregiver. I'm actually labeled a caregiver. Yeah. There's a title for what I do. But I didn't realize it because I'm just doing what I would do. He's my husband. We live together. Right. We've always helped each other out. We've been self-sufficient that way. So I just took on that role of doing that. Now, what I have learned about myself since then, and it actually took a long time to figure this out too, is that I became a more independent, more strong person because of what I have gone through. Because now it isn't David, you know, I grew up in the whole thing where not as bad as my mother and father did, where it's the woman stays home and the woman works. I had a career and everything. But it still was kind of that thing where the man is still the head of the household thing, if you can understand what I mean. And in the early 60s, early 70s through there. And so, and you know, not that we ever, defined it that way, But we each had our jobs. We each took care of things in the house. We each, you know, he took care of certain things, and I took care of certain things, and we made our household run. And without naming it, without naming what it was and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But technically, he took care of the finances. He knew what was going on with the mortgage of the house, the buying of the cars, all those big, heavy-duty things. And I just never even had a clue, you know, and that was my choice. I didn't want to know.
Right.
So when this happened, things had to change. They had to change.
Yeah.
It was being thrown in the deep end. If I didn't change, I wasn't going to survive. And if I didn't survive, David wasn't going to survive either. So things had to change, and I had to become an active, a more active part of our life. And I'm the one that now is taking care of the bills and all the financials and things like that. I bought our last car. I signed on the dotted line. I did all the negotiations. I would never have ever thought that I wouldn't have gone to David and say, well, what do you think? What do you think? What do you think? Now, of course, he was there with me, and he was hearing everything, but he did not say a word. He did not try to influence me. And I chose I was going between two different cars, and one he did not want. I knew that he didn't want it, but I liked it. You know, and I was weighing all these factors, you know. Wow, I really like this because it's little. I like a little car. You know, I don't want these. I'm kind of tiny myself. So I didn't want this big, huge thing. And I had come from a big SUV, an Escape and everything. So I thought, oh, this would be really cool. And I took the car and measured every single inch of it because I needed to know whether we could fit his recumbent trike in it because we have to put that in the car to travel. And we also make a trip to Santa Cruz once a year. And I needed to have enough room in there. So I was measuring every inch of this car. But, you know, it just had the appeal, you know, that woman appeal for a car. And the other one didn't. But I decided I better go with the right thing, make the right decision, and I got a car that I'm not in love with its looks. I like it, but I'm not in love with it like I was my last car. And he didn't say a word. He didn't say a word. He let me do it. But I asked him later, I said, what if I went for the other car? He said, I probably would have had to say something then. So it was kind of funny. It was kind of funny because I didn't think he was, you know, making any decisions on it, but. In fact, you know, he was in the background, but still allowing me the lead. And, you know, so it gave me a sense of accomplishment that I can do that. I can go in, you know, and take care of things. I can pay the bills. I can pay them once or twice or three times, you know, until I figured it out, because I did. And some I paid not at all. But I figured it out eventually, and now I am more capable of running my own life and his in that way. But, you know, he still does a lot of stuff. He's taken over a lot of jobs I do because I've taken over a lot of his. So it's almost like the tables have turned. But I always say, does not take out the trash. And I think he could, folks. But he says, oh, I can't do that because I say, oh, yeah, but you could. But anyhow, I'll still take out the trash. Don't worry, David. I know you're listening. So anyhow. So that's how I think I've changed immensely. I think I've become a stronger person. I think I've become a more outspoken person because I had to. If I didn't speak out about his care in the hospital, it would have not been good. I was there every minute because I made it happen. I just, you know, I talked to my principal, and I know I'm lucky on this part. I know I am. I know that I had very good employment, and my principal and my superintendent were all right behind me, and they let me take all my sick days. I mean, I could have taken them for any other time, or taken them at the end of my career. But they let me take my sick days. They gave me all my personal days. I used up every last day. So I didn't lose pay, which was good. And that's what allowed me to stay in the hospital. Because if I didn't, I wouldn't have been. And I understand that so many people don't have that privilege that I had. And I'm grateful for it. And I'm grateful to my principal, and I'm grateful to the superintendent for backing me up on this because it helped me to save my husband. And so when things went wrong there, I was there. And I was able to say, I don't want that nurse in here ever again. You know, and boy, that's not me. Mm-hmm. That isn't me at all.
Well,
but when the nurse was harming my husband by her ministration, she got fired out of his room fast.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And what I'm hearing from both of you is that, and I think this is so important because there are stages in recovery. So Jamie is a shorter recovery. Maybe she was younger, and so she recovered faster. But there's stages in recovery when you feel like, okay, this is it. This is hopeless. And you feel hopeless as the caregiver. A lot of times, you know, the person with the brain injury has this sense of hopelessness. And, and like, there's nothing worse than feeling there's no control and there's no hope. And that, when that moment happens, that's, you know, that's, Donna, why you do this show, I think, is so that people can know that, no, you know what, it's not hopeless. It's, you know. And what you guys are talking about, and I know for me, when I was in the hospital with Jamie, you know, taking care of Jamie, we had a situation where I had to just send somebody out and know you're not coming back in. I know you're not, well, you're not, you know, like, this is not going to happen. And so then the doctor said to me, so we had mostly all amazing doctors, but then this one particular doctor said to me, while Jamie is lying in the bed right next to him, awake, like she wasn't in a coma anymore, she was awake, she was doing some recovery, and he said, well, you know, we have an idea. And he's sitting on the bed, I'm sitting on the bed, and Jamie's lying on the bed. We think that you're the cause of Jamie's anxiety.
So oh, my gosh.
And so what we want to do is we want to have Jamie work with the speech therapist, the one that I said could never work with Jamie again. We want her to go and work with that speech therapist without you ever being there. We want you to, and I'm like, and Jamie, lying in the bed, has this look of absolute fear and panic. She didn't really have any words yet. That's why she had, the speech therapist. She couldn't speak words. And she had this look of terror. And her body crunched up, and she's kind of sat right up and was like clearly, I'm like, that's not even an option. Nope, not at all. We'll have to, if you can't provide us with adequate speech therapy, we just won't have any. We'll figure out something else. We'll leave here. We'll do something else. But we are not. There is no way I'm going to throw her to the wolves without, you know, like I'm willing to make progress to the point where she doesn't need me for speech therapy. But right now, she's afraid of that speech therapist. She could go with the occupational therapist, and she can go with the physical therapist without me. There's no problem with that. She loves them. She's having fun. But that speech therapist scared her, made her feel stupid.
Yeah.
And she doesn't want to have anything to do with it. But that's not me. Like, I don't, like, you know, it's like right now when something comes up, I can say that. I could not have said something and behaved that way before this. So we've really, the three of us, and the point for all of Donna's listeners that I want to really point out is that we were not who we became. The traumatic or the brain injury, I mean, they weren't all traumatic. The brain injury caused so much change in ourselves, our loved ones, that we all changed and we gained so much in ourselves from the adversity, from the, you know, we gained this new strength that none of us thought we didn't need it. And I don't think I would have ever thought that I would have ever spoken that way before, Jane. And it was just one incident. There were plenty of incidents where I'm like, no, that's not okay with Jamie. We're not doing that.
Yeah. No, I had several incidents like that, too. And I would never have done that. Even even when the nurses were saying, are you okay with this, on different things, not that particular thing I was talking about, but are you okay with this? Are you okay with this? And I would say, yeah, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine, because I basically am a people pleaser. I'd rather, you know, have everyone get along than to have strife or confrontation. And so I would say that's fine. And then when something happened, this is something else, I actually had David moved from a room because of the kind of thing goings on that was happening. So, yeah. And that's like, oh, my God, that's not me. I don't do that. I always say, oh, yes, sure, no matter, you know, whatever you want. But not when it came to his health. When it came to his health, mm-hmm. then I became a mama lion. You know, that's what it was. It was like, nope, you're not messing with my husband. Uh-uh. You know, and yet if something happening to me, I would never have said anything probably, you know. So, yeah, you do change in that respect. You do because you have to. You know, you have to.
Yeah.
And I hope that people understand, both caregivers and survivors out there listening, that it's a good thing. You know, it's a good thing that you can change mm-hmm. and grow that way if you need to. You know, and I'm sure that many people don't think about how they've changed, but, you know, take a step back and think about yourself in the beginning of your brain injury journey, whether you're the survivor or the caregiver, and see how you have changed to the positive, because I think that's what you need to think about.
You see, I think that was one of the problems. That was one of the problems with, in my situation, he wasn't changing.
Mm-hmm.
He stayed in his, and I think that was the source of a lot of the trouble, was that he was often, my mother was there with me during the surgeries. They both were. And my mother was mm-hmm. the one who fought for me. He didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And when she left, I was left with him, and there was a situation where, one of the reasons I didn't have any therapies when I got home was because of him. He didn't fight for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you know what, Deb? I think you are probably the norm.
Condition.
What?
Yes, I think you're right.
I think that you were probably the norm. I think that's what happens with a lot of people. I think that Fruit and I and David and Jamie are, you know, but we talk about this, even though we may not be the norm. This may not be what happens with most survivors and caregivers. I think it's important for you to know out there that this is what you should and can expect, or strive for at least, you know, because you're all worthy of this. You're worthy of love. You're worthy of respect. And you should be able to, you know, someone in your life should be able to stand up for you. But, you know, it doesn't always happen.
But
your spouse or your mother, father, if somebody isn't there to do that for you, there are brain alliances in every state, injury alliances.
Yes.
So in every state, so reach out. If you're not getting with your personal caretaker what you need, reach out, because there are you can Google them, you can, call them up. They are the people who are involved with them are so supportive and so wanting to help you.
Mm-hmm.
Not help you as though you're, I don't know, it's not a negative helpy, it's a really positive, really, really positive helpy thing.
Part of the problem there is I didn't have the wherewithal. All the stuff I got, I didn't have the wherewithal to get it. I mean, the things that I got were the things that I could handle, but I didn't end up mm-hmm. having any speech therapy or physical therapy afterwards because I didn't have the wherewithal to deal with it. I knew about certain things.
And that's I'm going to have to say, folks,
Oh, yes, Donna, your end of your show is happening. Oh, my goodness.
Yes.
Okay. So, Donna.
That's
Donna.
What's happening.
last week, ahead. Donna was on Jamie's show. This week, I'm on Donna's show. And next week, I'm on Jamie's show. So I'm on a whole roll. Donna and I are on a 3-week roll here. So go ahead, Donna.
Wow.
You do your ending. And don't forget to plug my Jamie like you always do, and she always says.
Oh, I always plug her. Every year. I mean, every week I plug her. Always. Yeah.
And
yeah,
she
I hate for
you
this
every
to end, but
time like that.
Does she? Oh, great. I hate for this to end. This just flew by. It was so great. And I don't think we got near, again, I say this every time, we never finish. We never do. So folks, you have to just tune back in to find out what's going to happen next. Because these two lovely ladies, Deb Brandon and Fruit Grace Mosey, will definitely be back on. And we will definitely be figuring things out in the brain injury community as we try to go through this mishmash of brain injury. So, but before we even do my, before I even go to my ending thing, so you mentioned the Brain Injury Alliances and the association. There is a Brain Injury Association dot, so it's BIAUSA.org. That is a Brain Injury Association that is over the entire United States. And Fruit mentioned that each state has some form of a brain injury alliance or association, not necessarily connected with them, but they do tell you which ones are in your state. So the brain injury, I'm in Arizona, and the Brain Injury Alliance of Arizona, which is BIAAZ, I always like to talk to, shout out to for them because they're amazing. I wasn't until I moved to the desert that I found them, but they're amazing. They just do so much for our brain injury community with classes, with workshops. Now it's all viral workshops, yeah, via Zoom. So that brings me to my invite to everybody who is listening out there, because I'm going to be speaking at the Brain Injury Alliance of Arizona, BIAAZ.org. I never get that right. And it's here on one of my papers that are spread across my desk. BIAAZ.org. Carrie, if you're listening, I apologize. I will be there virtually. I will be there on Saturday, October 24th. From 10:30 till 12 a.m., and that's Phoenix time. So if you translate it out, think Pacific time, because right now that's what we are on, just Arizona. So 10:30 a.m. Pacific time. It's a free virtual event, and I will be talking about my book, Prisoners Without Bars, A Caregiver's Tale, which was published by Right Life Publishing in 2018, November. And you can register for this event at biaaz.org/events. You can put my name into the search box there or Google that with that involved and copy with the authors. The wonderful thing is the first 15 registrants do get a free copy of my book. So that is really cool. So you can read it, and then we can talk about it, and I will answer questions, and I will read an excerpt. So, yeah, that's my big plug today for both my book and my coffee with the authors. So thank you to Fruit and to Deb again, always again, thank you for all the conversation tonight. And next time, I should say, you can learn, we're having a lot of breakup here, I think, but you can learn a lot more about Fruit and her daughter, Jamie Crane Mosey, Grace Mosey, and it's M-A-U-Z-Y, on my blog, survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com, and Deb Brandon, also on survivingtraumaticbraininjury.com. And don't forget, you can also check out Deb's book, But My Brain Had Other Ideas. I don't know if I got that exactly right, but My Brain Had Other Ideas. Yeah, A Memoir of Recovery from Brain Injury. So check out Deb's book, too. I can guarantee a good read because I read it. So, on the next date, I will be interviewing Craig J. Phillips, and he is a rehabilitation counselor, an advocate, a keynote speaker, and he's also the creative director of Second Chances to Live. And so Craig is going to be coming on the show to talk all about his journey through the brain injury, his brain injury maze. So let's see, what else do I have to say? As always, I say, if you liked my show, please tell 10 of your friends. If you hated it, well, tell 10 of your enemies. That works for me, always does. And the clock has ticked up to 6:50. That's Pacific time. So we're going to have to say goodbye, but don't forget to stay tuned to the next show with Matt Duffin. It starts at 7 p.m. Pacific time. And I'll see you on October 16. I think I had that up. I have it written here somewhere, too. October 16 for Craig J. Phillips. And don't forget to tune in next Sunday to Jamie Crane Mosey on her show, Life Gets Mo Crazy. And her shows run every Sunday, the second and fourth Sundays. Mine run the first and third. Aha, there was a reason for that. Anyhow, and Bruce also mentioned that she's going to be a guest on her daughter's show next week, so that should be a really fun show to listen to. So on that note, folks, again, I hope you all have a very safe and healthy week and 2 weeks for me, and we'll see you again on the 16th. Deb Brandon, thank you very much for